I like the way she says delightful talk. Ego-bashing talk, actually. Because I figure unless people leave a Dharma talk feeling a little bit uncomfortable, then the talk hasn't really been successful. You know, if you come out feeling light and love and bliss, then, you know, then you haven't seen, you know, what your problem is. And without seeing what our problem is, we don't know how to remove it. Yeah. So I think, you know, the sign that the Dharma is coming through loud and clear is when we feel a little bit like they've been poking at me. Yeah. Okay, so we'll start with a little bit of meditation before we have the talk. Okay, so sit up straight. Have your hands in your lap, the right and the left, the thumbs are touching. And lower your eyes. And begin simply by feeling yourself sitting here on the cushion. So be aware of your body in this room, together with others who have a similar goal in life, like-minded people. Then become aware of your body, the sensations in your body, if there's any tightness or tension anywhere. See if you can just let that go. So check your belly, check your shoulders. Make sure your jaw isn't clenched. Then become aware of your breath, letting your breathing pattern be what it is. And place your attention either at the belly and observe the rise and fall of the belly as you inhale and exhale, or place your attention at the upper lip and the nostrils and feel the sensation of the air as it passes there. So keep your focus on the breath. If you get distracted, don't get mad at yourself or anything, but instead bring your attention back home to the breath. And as you watch your breath, really feel how it connects you to the rest of the universe and how your breathing nourishes your body, keeps you alive. So we'll do this for a few minutes to settle the mind. Then let's spend a moment and generate our motivation. and really put what we're about to do within the context of being of benefit to other living beings, and to do this through improving the state of our own mind, purifying it, cultivating our good qualities, and through working with our own mind, become wiser, more compassionate, more skillful, and more capable of being of great benefit to all other living beings, especially in the long term by attaining full awakening ourselves, so that we can lead them on the path. So let's have that long-term motivation be in our hearts and be the reason that we're here this evening. And then slowly open your eyes and come out of your meditation. So, living with an open heart. Yeah. It's the title of the new book that I co-authored with Dr. Russell Coltz, who's a clinical psychologist. And he does something called compassion-focused therapy, which I was really impressed with, that, you know, therapists nowadays are thinking about compassion and the important role of compassion in solving our, you know, emotional problems of this life. So I think that's quite good, quite positive. And so the book was written, we put in Buddhist information, but without, you know, talking Buddhist language, so that the book's designed for people of any religion or people of no religion. Yeah, so this is a book you can give to your mom and dad. Yeah, and it doesn't say Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, Karma, Nirvana, Samsara, you know, all these funny kind of words. It just talks normal English. So I wrote the section in the book specifically about how to cultivate compassion, because this is one of the ways where the Buddhist teachings really shine. Now, and I know as somebody who didn't grow up Buddhist, but I met the Dharma when I was 24, this is one of the things that really impressed me with the Buddhist teachings, was the Buddha didn't just say, be compassionate, but he told you how to be compassionate. In other words, how to get your mind to cooperate with what you want to be. Yeah, because as we all know, we can't tell ourselves feel this or feel that, and then all of a sudden we feel it. Like, don't be angry, and then the anger goes away. Wouldn't that be nice? Tell ourselves don't be angry, and poof, it's gone. Or tell ourselves be compassionate. Whoop, there's the compassion. Be so nice if it were that easy, but it isn't, you know. These are qualities that we really need to make an effort to deliberately and conscientiously cultivate. Yeah, we have the seeds of these qualities like love and compassion in our mind right now, but they're just little seeds, you know. We need to nourish them and make them grow. Yeah, and this is really where the Buddha's teachings are so effective, because if we practice them, yeah, then they work. If we don't practice them, then of course they don't work. Yeah, part of our problem is we know them, but we don't practice them. Okay, it's like having the medicine, but it's sitting on the shelf, and you get sick, and you look all over the house for some medicine, or you forget that you have medicine, so you don't even look for it. and the whole time crying, why isn't there medicine for what I'm sick with? Yeah. So when we've encountered the Buddha's teachings, you know, we really have to not just know them like having the medicine, but actually take the medicine and practice them and habituate ourselves with the teachings. It isn't that, you know, practicing, you know, once or twice or something is going to completely revolutionize our mind and undo all the bad mental habits that we have. You know, again, if it were only so easy to do that, wouldn't it be nice? Yeah. But it isn't, you know, it's called practice for a reason. Yeah, practice is because you have to do it again and again and again. Okay, it's like learning to type, you know. You remember learning to type? You have to keep doing it and build up the habit. So same thing here. So if we want to live with an open heart, we have to really counteract our self-centered mind, the mind that just is focused around me, I, my, and mine. You know, the mind that says I'm the most important one in the universe. My suffering hurts more than anybody else's. My happiness is more important than anyone else's. Yeah, so we have to do something about that mind. And we also have to do something about the mind that is called self-grasping ignorance, the mind that misapprehends how the I, the self, the person exists, and how all other phenomena also exist. Okay, so those two minds, the self-centered mind and the self-grasping ignorance, are the two biggest enemies. Yeah. Have any of you read the text, The Wheel of Sharp Weapons? Yeah, it's a fantastic thought training text. And the author, Dharma Rakshita, really points out these two as our big enemy. Yeah, we usually think other people are our enemy. And if we destroy other people, then, you know, the source of our problems will go away. But actually, other people have been very kind to us and keep us alive. And our real enemy is what's in here, our distorted ways of apprehending things, our mistaken views, our disturbing and afflictive emotions. Those are the things that are really the biggest enemy. Yeah. Shantideva has, in his text, Guide to a Bodhisattva's Way, he talks a lot about this and, you know, how other people, the most harm they can ever inflict on us is to take our life, yeah? Which is pretty heavy, but they cannot make us have a lower rebirth, yeah? They can stop this life, but they can't send us to a lower rebirth. Yeah. What sends us to the lower rebirth is the internal enemy, that self-grasping ignorance, the self-centered mind, the ignorance, anger, and attachment. Yeah. Those are the things that cause us the biggest suffering. So those are the things that we really need to get rid of, yeah. Not to get rid of other sentient beings. Because as we all know from watching any political situation or even our personal situation, as soon as we destroy one enemy, two more come about. Yeah, because when we destroy one living being or hurt one living being, then other people get really upset about it, and then we wind up with double trouble. So this method that we've used until now to harm others, either verbally by criticizing them or physically by harming their body or even mentally by sitting and planning how we're going to get even. Yeah. how we're going to make them suffer for what they did to us. You know, how all of that actually inflicts harm on ourselves. Yeah, it harms us more than it harms anybody else. Yeah, so the real enemy is inside. So, to overcome this self-centered attitude, you know, the chief opposite factor to self-centeredness is the mind, or the minds of love and compassion. Love wanting sentient beings to have happiness in its causes, compassion wanting them to be free of suffering in its causes. Okay? But how do we generate this kind of love and compassion for others? Yeah? Especially when some of them are such jerks. Yeah? I mean, it'd be really nice if other people weren't so abominable sometimes, because then they'd be quite easy to love and have compassion for. But sometimes they are just, you know, they're off the wall. What do they want from us? So, you know, if we keep waiting for the time when everybody is wonderful in order to have love and compassion for them, we're going to be waiting long, you know, after the cows come home, okay, because it's not going to happen. Yeah, they're sentient beings. Their minds are, you know, overwhelmed by afflictions, just like us. So we have to find another way to do it besides waiting for them to change. Yeah. And so what we do instead to develop compassion is we think about their kindness to us, and we also contemplate their unsatisfactory condition in cyclic existence. Okay. However, to really see others as kind and to have love and compassion for them, we also have to get rid of our favoritism and our bias. Yeah. And as much as we like to see ourselves as unbiased individuals, actually, we have very clear categories of friend, enemy, and stranger, don't we? Yeah, friends, the people that we're attached to, that we want to be with. Yeah, enemies, we'll just use that, you know, it doesn't mean like an enemy in a duel. It just means somebody maybe who you don't feel safe with, somebody who threatens you. Threatens your happiness. Somebody who you argue with, you know, we'll just give the general term enemy to that, to those kind of people. And then the third category is strangers, people that we usually feel kind of neutral towards, not one way, not the other. So we have quite distinguished categories: friend, enemy, stranger. Attachment for the friends, anger and aversion for the enemies, indifference for the strangers. And it appears to us, just to our normal mind when we don't analyze, that people from their own side appear to be friends or enemies and strangers. It appears that, you know, the friend exists in the other person, and the enemy exists in the other person, and the stranger exists, you know, in the status of the other person. It doesn't seem like these three categories depend on our mind, does it? Yeah. It just seems like you look at one person, and wow, they're a really nice person. So, yeah, they're a friend. You look at another person, and this guy's just an idiot. So, of course, they're an enemy. You know, and you look at somebody else who you don't know, you put them in the stranger category. So it seems like from their own side, people divide themselves into friends, enemies, and strangers, as if it didn't have anything to do with us at all. Does it appear that way to you when you You know, look at other people. Yeah. But when we start to look a little bit more closely and scratch the surface, we come to see that, you know, we actually play a role in people being friends, enemies, and strangers. Okay? And we play a role in creating the emotions of attachment, anger, and apathy that we feel for these three groups respectively. Okay? So let's do a little experiment. Okay? Close your eyes for a minute. Well, a few minutes here. Think of somebody, a specific individual that you're very attached to, and imagine them in front of you, somebody who you really want to be with. You're very connected and attached with too. And then just ask yourselves, why am I so attached to this friend or relative, whoever it is? And there's no right or wrong answers. Just listen to what your mind says. Why am I so attached to them? And then imagine in the space in front of you somebody who you really don't like. You know, somebody who's an enemy. And then ask yourself, why do I have such anger and aversion towards this person? Again, there's no right or wrong answer. Just investigate. Why do I have such aversion? And then think of a stranger, somebody who you don't really know, and ask yourself, why do I feel kind of indifferent or apathetic towards that person? Again, no right or wrong answers, just investigate what our mind is thinking. Okay, then open your eyes. So why are you attached to your friends? What did your mind say?
They're easy.
They're easy? Easy meaning what?
They're just easy, they're not difficult.
Yeah. Oh, okay, so it's easy to get along with them and yeah. Yeah, they don't cause me problems. Okay, what else? They're warm? Yeah, just warm in general? Yeah, because if they were warm towards your enemy, it would warm towards you. Okay, yeah, so loving towards you. Okay, what else? Okay. So people who make us very joyful, who we share a lot of joy with and enrich our lives. Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes a long-term connection, so you don't have to talk and explain yourself very much because they understand you. Yeah. What else? Ice cream. Oh, okay. So we enjoy other good activities that we like with them. Yeah. What else? Yeah, we laugh together. Yeah, yeah. If we're down, they support us and... You know, they encourage us. Yeah, they see our potential. Yeah, they take the time to get to know us. They don't just brush us off.
I think long-term friends are very consistent. I have friends that I think might be for 40 years, and that they accept.
Okay. Yeah, okay. So people who want us to be happy, who we want to be happy, who we're connected to, who accept us the way we are without judging us, yeah, who can give us good advice. Yeah, sometimes there's an instant connection. It doesn't hurt that they look good. I'm joking. Yeah, we just feel some kind of connection with them, yeah. Okay, what about the enemies? Why do we have such hostility towards that group of people? They make us uncomfortable, yeah. Yeah, they bully us. What else? They don't like us. Yeah, that's breaking the first rule of the universe, that they don't like us. How dare they not like me? Yeah.
They mean to us. They gave us a lot of trouble.
Yeah. They're mean to us. They criticize us. They dump their problems on us and expect us to solve their problems. Oh, yeah. They make us feel uncomfortable about something in ourselves that we don't really want to own up to or acknowledge. Yeah. What else? Yeah, sure. Yeah, there might be actual physical danger from these people. Yeah, for sure. Okay, then what about the strangers? Why do you feel kind of apathetic, indifferent, couldn't care less about strangers? Yeah, we don't know them. What else?
I thought I didn't have a responsibility to them, which really surprised me, actually.
Ah, yeah, they're somehow other, yes. And they're kind of like just the pictures on the wall. You know, they're not real human beings who we have to engage with. Yeah. Right, we don't have the time, we don't take the time. Yeah. Okay, so in this whole discussion of, you know, friend, enemy, stranger, of attachment, aversion, and apathy, what word kept coming up? Oh, me. How interesting. Gee, the word me kept coming up. I wonder why that happened. Yeah, they like me, they encourage me, they threaten me, they disagree with my ideas, they get in my way, they don't affect me, they love me. They remember my birthday. They don't remember my birthday. Gee, you know, it seems like, you know, maybe they aren't friend, enemy, and stranger objectively from their own side, but maybe we put them in these three camps because of how they relate to us. Does that make some sense? How they relate to us. So we put them in the friend camp if they relate to us in a way that makes us happy. In the enemy camp if they relate to us in a way that makes us unhappy. And in the stranger camp if they don't relate to us at all or, you know, don't affect us one way or the other. So in actual fact, friends, enemies, and strangers are not objectively friends, enemies, and strangers. But they're dependent relationships, dependent on how they relate to... Da 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 the center of the universe! Me! Isn't it? Yeah? Yeah? Somebody becomes a good person, not objectively from their side, but because they show their good qualities to me. They become a bad or obnoxious person, again, not from their own side, but because they show their faults towards me. They become a neutral person because they don't show anything much towards me. Yeah? And we feel entitled to toss them in one of the three boxes. Yeah? Where we think they're going to remain forever after. Yeah. Just because of how they treat us. So it's very interesting. Somebody may be in the friend box for a while, and then as soon as they do something we don't like, they go into the enemy box. Yeah? I mean, think about it. You fall in love with somebody this year, next year you can't stand them. Sometimes you wait 5 years, 10 years. But, you know, it goes from this box to that box. All based on how they affect the most important one in the universe. It's true, isn't it? It's true. As soon as we look at somebody in relationship to ourselves everything becomes actually quite biased. We don't really see the person as they are, but we see them only through this little periscope of I, me, my, and mine that simply looks at how they relate to me. Yeah. If somebody is kind and gentle and encouraging to me, they're a wonderful person. If they are kind and gentle and encouraging to somebody I can't stand, then I also can't stand them too. Right? Yeah, if somebody is nice to your enemy, that you put them in the enemy box. Yeah. If somebody shows all their faults towards us, they nag, they pester, they're short-tempered, they're an enemy, and we think they're an obnoxious person from their own side. If they nag and pester and get angry at somebody else who we don't like, you're smart, you agree with me. Yeah, go ahead, get on that other person. Okay, so we're actually, you know, first of all, people do not exist in and of themselves objectively as friends, enemies, and strangers. But we put them in those categories depending on how they relate to us. And then based on which category we put them in, we generate attachment or anger or apathy. When a person goes from one category to the other, yeah, because of how they related to me, then how I feel about them changes. Yeah. When we were first born, everybody was a stranger. Yeah? Everybody was a stranger. Then some people benefited us. They became friends. Some people harmed us. They became enemies. Yeah? Then we get to school, you know, kindergarten or first grade or whatever it is. Yeah? And we had friends in first grade. Most of our first grade friends we've lost touch with. They've gone into the stranger category. So we used to be very attached to them. Mom, I want to play with so-and-so. And now we don't even remember them from one day to the next. Yeah. Other people who we couldn't stand when we were in first grade or kindergarten, yeah, we may have, some of them also went into the stranger category. And we stopped feeling angry at them and just felt apathetic. Some of those people that we couldn't stand in first grade, we meet them many years later, and they're kind of cool. And they go into the friend category. Meanwhile, some of the people in the friend category were nasty to us later on. They went into the enemy category. And so what we have is all these relationships are in constant flux. Yeah, they're always changing. So to really see friends, enemies, and strangers as concrete relationships doesn't make much sense because they're all likely to change in the next day or two or year or two or whatever. You know, and they're certainly going to change from one lifetime to the next. So seeing, first of all, the changeable nature of these relationships, and second of all, the subjective nature, how completely subjective, yeah, our notions of other people are, you know. When we really look at this, then we have to ask ourselves, yeah, is the whole way I'm looking at sentient beings accurate or not? Yeah? Is it really accurate? Because the disadvantage of having friends, enemies, and strangers is that we can't look at everybody in an equal-hearted way. And because we get attached to some people, then our love and compassion are quite biased. Yeah? I love you. I have compassion for you. As long as you encourage me, share the same ideas I do, remember my birthday, encourage me when I'm down, put up with me when I'm, you know, a jerk, defend me when others criticize me. If you do all of that, then I'll keep you in the friend box. But if you don't do all of that, then I'm going to put you in another box, and my whole feeling towards you is going to change. Yeah? And so we find our feelings towards others constantly changing. Yeah? Constantly changing just based on small things that people do. And we can see it day by day. Somebody smiles at us. Oh, good. I feel happy. They go in the friend category. The next day, that person doesn't smile at us. Oh, I'm dejected. Yeah, they don't love me. How stupid they are. Yeah, they go in the enemy category. So, Lama Yeshe had an expression, yo-yo mind. Remember the toys we used to play with when we were kids, yo-yos? So our mind is like a yo-yo. When we put somebody in the friend category, the yo-yo's up. And then somebody changes their behavior, the yo-yo goes down and we don't like them. And then it goes up and it goes down, it goes up and it goes down. And so we find it difficult to relate to others in a very balanced way. And people really don't know from one day to the next what they're going to encounter when they relate to us, because we are so moody and fickle and change our mind all the time. And we're so easily offended, so that if they do the slightest thing we don't like, then we just change them from one box to the other. And we're actually quite judgmental towards other people. You know, they really have to work hard to stay on our good side. Because the slightest little thing, yeah, you annoy me just even a little bit. Yeah? You're going on probation into the enemy box. And you better do a whole lot to, earn me, you know. You have to earn being in my friend box. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, this kind of discriminating mind that we have, that sees other beings only in terms of how they relate to us, it actually causes a lot of confusion in our life and in the lives of others. And it really impedes our spiritual practice, because, you know, we can't have equal-hearted care and compassion for everybody. So, in order really to have love and compassion, then we have to do something about our attachment, our aversion, and our apathy. Yeah, and we have to get rid of those. We have to stop seeing people in terms of how they relate to me, and start seeing them in a much broader way, as just being sentient beings who want to be happy and don't want to suffer. Yeah. So instead of seeing them as young or old or attractive or unattractive, yeah, instead of seeing them as, you know, in our political party or in the other political party, you know, as part of our group or part of the other group, instead of seeing them as highly educated or lowly educated, as rich, as poor, as male, as female, you know, instead of all these categories that we put people in and think that we understand them by putting them in these different categories, just to see everybody in a very equal way as a living being who wants to be happy and doesn't want to suffer. Because that's the bottom line, no matter who we look at, yeah, and this applies to all human beings, but not only human beings, it applies to animals and insects. Yeah, it applies to every kind of life form that has consciousness. They just want to be happy and don't want to suffer. And that's the bottom line. Yeah. So if we really want to develop the kind of love and compassion that we're talking about in Buddhism that can be spread equally to everybody, we have to take down these barriers that our self-centered mind erects between other people and also between us and them. Agree? Yeah, we really have to work at it. And so that means retraining our mind to look into everybody's heart in a very deep way. You know? And the way we do that is by seeing that no matter who it is, they want to be happy and they don't want to suffer. Okay, so you might see a cockroach, and instead of going, "Hey, it's a cockroach," you know, look at it and think, that's a living being who just wants to be happy and doesn't want to suffer. Yeah. I've been hearing a lot about Tony Abbott since I've been in Australia. Yeah. I didn't know who he was before, but I gather he's related to George Bush. Yeah? Are they cousins or something? Yeah? And so, you know, to be able to look into Abbott's mind or Bush's mind, you know, and there's a sentient being who's trying to be happy and not suffer. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah, and we look and it's like, yeah, it's exactly right. They want to be happy and they don't want to suffer. And they're so confused that they make other people suffer, thinking that it will bring about their own happiness. That's the depth of confusion in these people's minds. You know? And it's the depth of confusion in our own mind because we do the same thing, don't we? Yeah? When we're really in pain, we will hurt somebody else, even though what we really want is to be happy and to not suffer. But we're so confused that we think if we harm somebody else, it'll stop them from harming me. Yeah. Or in the case often of politicians or people who are CEOs in companies or whatever, they think that by doing a certain action, it will, you know, bring benefit. And it won't, you know. There's a lot of ignorance there. But you know, we can't put ourselves above them because how many times have we done actions that we thought would bring benefit and we wound up to be completely wrong? Yeah? So, you know, this is all a process of not only equalizing friend, enemy, and stranger and seeing them in the same light, but also equalizing them and us. Yeah, because if we don't equalize them and us, then our self-centered mind is going to put us up looking at all these really screwed up sentient beings, you know, who just can't get their act together. They want to be happy. They don't want to suffer. They do all these stupid things. They're not like me. I want to be happy and don't want to suffer, but I always do the right thing. Yeah? And I always think the right thing. And if only these stupid people followed my advice, everything would be good. Yeah? So you see, we have to equalize between self and others. Otherwise, we're going to put ourselves up and look down on others. And that's not going to be very realistic either. Because if we really think about it, you know, if I don't know anything about Tony Abbott's background. I mean, I know George Bush was, you know, an oil family in Texas. Yeah, imagine being born into an oil family in Texas. What was Abbott's background? Anybody know? Catholic? Yeah. He was trained to be a Catholic priest. Huh. No? He's not from a rich family?
He was well-to-do, I think. Like, he was involved in student politics in the University of Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
And he made a lot of enemies there. And and when he got sued and all that, it was his parents actually got high-caliber bars to defend him.
Okay. Yeah. So it would be interesting to think, you know, if I had grown up in his family. Yeah.
Sorry. The other thing as well that I know about him is that his mother always knew that her son was going to be prime minister.
Oh. So a little bit of parental pressure. Yeah.
I don't know too much about him. I love him. And I think the motto in the family was, let Tony be Tony when he, you know, when he tries to kick heads of other people.
So people, his family put up with him a lot. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. In any case, just imagine, you know, growing up in his family with, you know, kind of what the kind of conditioning he had. Yeah. Because I think of, you know, kind of my favorite one was George Bush, and like growing up in an oil family from Texas, a rich oil family that was politically connected, that could pull this string and that string and get anybody to do what they wanted. Yeah. If I grew up in that kind of environment, I probably would have thought like George Bush. Oh, what a thought, you know? Yeah. But if you think about it, you know, I don't know, do any of you remember the Rodney King episode in the U.S.? You remember that, okay? Yeah, so Rodney King, you know, I forget what he did, but anyway, the police were chasing him, yeah, and they dragged him out of his car and beat him to a pulp, and, you know, he was black, the police were white, and then the neighborhood that had you know, I think that he was from, or, you know, there were a lot of Koreans in there, and so they got involved. And it was, there were riots in Los Angeles about the incident. And I remember at that time thinking, you know, if I had grown up in Rodney King's family, I probably would have acted like him. And if I had grown up in the families of those police, I very well might have acted like them. And if I had grown up in the families of the Korean grocers who rioted, I would have, you know, acted like them. And it became very clear to me, you know, that I don't have some fixed personality whereby I can hold myself superior to others. That if I were conditioned in this way or that way, who knows what I might wind up acting like. Yeah. And so therefore, to put myself above anybody else or below anybody else, was really quite out of place, because as long as I have the seeds of ignorance, anger, and attachment within myself, those seeds, you know, if depending on what seeds get watered, those qualities are going to grow. Yeah. So it brings about a bit of humility, and also some understanding for other people's situation and understanding for the pain that they experience and understanding for why people do what they do. Yeah, they're basically just trying to be happy and not suffer, even though sentient beings do all sorts of crazy things to get, you know, in an attempt to get happiness and avoid suffering. And we're part of those, you know, sentient beings that sometimes do not act very rationally. Okay? So when we think like this, we even the playing field and we are able to develop more understanding for others and less judgment for them. And then that opens the door to actually wishing them well with love and wishing them to be free of suffering with compassion. Okay? So this whole way of thinking that we've gone through, you know, up until here, this is something that you want to practice on your meditation cushion. But it's also very good to practice in other situations. Okay? I am in airports a lot, okay? So I look at the people around me. Now, they're trying to be happy and not suffer. Yeah. If you're in traffic jams a lot, does Sydney have really bad traffic jams? Yeah? Bumper to bumper where it doesn't move? Okay, yeah. This is an excellent meditation to do in a traffic jam, because you can look around at all the other people in the cars and all the different creatures flying by, you know, and think they all want to be happy and none of them want to suffer, just like me. Yeah. I've been taking some walks around the neighborhood. What I see this very interesting looking bird. It's kind of a big bird with a very long beak. Ivan? I bird. What? Ibin. Ibins. Like iPod. Huh? I-B-I-N, Ibin. Ibins. I-B-I-N-S. Oh, I-B-I-S. Ibis. Oh, okay. Yeah, so I was watching this Ibis kind of cross the road. Huh? Yeah. And just thinking, like, what would it be like to be that kind of animal in the middle of a city, crossing a road, not realizing the danger? Yeah? Do they fly? They do? Okay, I haven't seen them fly. But, you know, I was quite concerned about this ibis in the road. And, you know, so you start really looking at all these different sentient beings that you encounter here and there. And really, you know, looking in their heart, just trying to be happy, not trying to suffer. Yeah. And I walk by the school. It looks like a private boys' school where they wear suits and ties and, you know. I'm like, oh, they're just, you know, sentient beings trying to be happy, not suffer. It's very interesting, you know, sometimes you see people that just fulfill this stereotype for you. It depends, we all have different stereotypes. I grew up in the hippie generation, so that kind of colors a lot of my perceptions. So a few weeks ago I was at Marquette University. It's a Catholic university in Wisconsin. I was invited to give some talks there. So I was going to be talking to a class, and the students were coming in, and most of them were dressed like college students. I don't know how college students here dress, but in the States, you know, they're wearing hoodies and, you know, relaxed kind of clothes. Yeah. And then one young man walks in. He's tall, wearing slacks, a button-down shirt, you know, short hair, impeccable, polished black shoes. And he's tall, and he sits down. And you know how men sit when they think they're really powerful, how they put one leg down and another leg kind of on their first leg? Yeah, the guys probably aren't aware of it, but I don't know. You want to exhibit it? No, you didn't do it. You can't hold your foot. You have to sit down and very authoritatively, you know, you have your foot and then you put your other foot on top of it and look out at the world. Okay? Yeah, so he sat down like this. And my mind went, I know all about this kid. He's some spoiled rich kid from a family that, you know, a Republican family, and he thinks he's, you know, he thinks he's the king of the world and, you know, totally conceited. You know? And I thought I knew everything about this kid just from looking at him and the way he sat down. Yeah. So it was quite interesting for me to, you know, I realized that my mind was doing this right away and to say, okay, you know, come back. He's a sentient being who's just trying to be happy. You know, because I was sitting there going, you know, like this spoiled rich kid, blah, 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 who's going to sit through my whole talk in that posture. Yeah, you know, with his leg crossed like that, looking at me, you know. So it's like, okay, I got to get psyched up. There's going to be somebody like that in the audience, but I'm going to give a Dharma talk, and I'm not going to, you know, let the way he's looking at me influence me, because I got to speak to the other kids who really are interested, you know. Had to prep my mind for it. And then it was very interesting, you know, because I started talking, and then, you know, he went from his position. And he's leaning forward and listening by the end. I was so surprised. Yeah? So it was a very good experience for me, you know, there's my stereotype totally out the window. Yeah. Another comparable stereotype, I went into, because I do prison work, so I went into San Quentin prison. San Quentin is one of the big bad prisons in California. So I was giving a talk there. So some of the young kids, the lifers in San Quentin, you know, some of the guys who are lifers, they know that they have to, you know, make a life for themselves in prison, and they're really interested in what you have to say. Some of the kind of young, swanky ones who are going to get out in a few years, who are planning what they're going to do when they get out, you know, what kind of dope they're going to smoke, and, you know, who they're going to go hang out with and what trouble they're going to get into. Yeah? So one of, you know, a few of these kids walked in like that. And so one of them kind of sat down, you know. And so they have their posture too, not the rich, spoiled brat, you know, college preppy kid posture, but the, you know, which is, you know, well, anyway. And, but they have the... No, I'm not. This is totally objective. And, you know, but that he sat down, you know, stretched his legs out in front of him. This posture. Like, okay, white lady, let's see what you have to say for yourself. So, actually, he didn't I was actually more disturbed by the spoiled rich kid than I was by this guy, actually, looking back on it. Anyway, you know, so there's that guy in the kind of, you know, thing. And again, I just had to give my Dharma talk and, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. But again, similar thing with him, you know, from going like this to, you know, sitting up and then uncrossing his arms, yeah, and leaning forward, listening. Yeah, really kind of remarkable. And then, okay, there's another stereotype out the window. Yeah, the kind of gang member, swanky, you know, brat, not swanky brat, but, you know, rebellious, yeah, rebellious one, you know, again, out the window, you know, who am I to judge? I can't tell how people are going to react. I can't tell who they are. I have to really just, you know, deal with what's in front of me and stop judging people and stop thinking I know everything about them based on how they're sitting and what they're wearing. Mm-hmm. And it really kind of shows that, you know, if you take time, there's probably some way to have a good conversation with everybody. If you take the time to think about what you have in common with somebody or what they know about that you don't know anything about that it would be interesting to learn about. Yeah? And then to start up a discussion with somebody and really learn from that person what it's like to be them. And, you know, to see that it's actually possible to find a way to talk to everybody. Yeah, if we slow down and we look in their hearts and we're really interested. Yeah. And so that can then really open the door, you know, in our spiritual practice to all sorts of things, yeah. To be having patience and fortitude and not getting upset when people say this and that to us. Yeah? To abandoning the judgmental, critical mind. To seeing the beauty in each and every living being. You know? And to be able to have some loving kindness and compassion for each person. knowing that they all can change and will change. Okay? So very good meditation to do, you know, in a traffic jam, sitting on a bus, in an airport, yeah, sitting in a movie theater waiting for the movie to start, look around at all the people and think this. When you go for a walk out in nature, you know, look at the animals and the insects. Yeah, think about this for them. Okay. So, and we have a little bit of time for questions or comments. Right. Okay. So teaching children or adults, you know, well, first of all, children, I don't know if children always know what their gut feelings are, first of all. Yeah, you know, adults teach them. But I think the thing is to teach kids to look out for certain behaviors. In other words, not to judge the person, but to know if there's certain behaviors that could signal danger. Okay? So again, separating out the behavior from the person. And also as us as adults, knowing, you know, being able to tell which kind of behaviors could signal some danger. Yeah? And just being aware of those behaviors, but not necessarily saying this person is an awful person. Yeah? But, you know, when those behaviors are being exhibited, I need to be careful in this situation.
Mm-hmm. So no one's going to take responsibility for me other than me.
Mm-hmm.
So there has to be a core sort of action that I need to take to move someone from what I thought was possibly a friend, a stranger, to an enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's where I get a bit confused. Like I really don't know what I'm trying to say.
Oh, okay. I think I know what you're getting at. There's a difference between the action and the person. And, you know, when we look at people, so we can evaluate actions that may indicate trouble. At the same time, saying this person is a living being who wants to be happy and not suffer. Okay. And this person has the Buddha nature. Yeah, they're not an inherently evil person. Yeah, we have to get out of this mindset that says somebody is an inherently evil person. You know, we can't say that because they have the Buddha nature. They have the possibility to become an enlightened being. Yeah. But having equanimity in this way and not being biased does not mean that we act the same way towards everybody. Okay? So there's a difference between our mental feeling of care and concern for everybody equally and then how we act towards people in different situations. You act with a 2-year-old different than you act with a 20-year-old. Yeah? We don't act the same way towards everybody. Yeah, you invite a friend into your home to stay overnight. That doesn't mean that you also invite a stranger into your home to stay overnight. Yeah, we act differently towards different people depending on the social relationship. However, in our mind, we try and have, you know, some equanimity towards all of them. Okay, so if somebody is exhibiting behavior that we don't feel safe with, from our side, we can still have equal-hearted care and concern for them and say, you know, I need to behave differently with this person in order to protect myself in case there is some danger here. Okay? Yeah.
As to whether that implies that we have to reduce attachment to them in order for it to be.
Yes, it does imply that. Yeah. So there's a difference between loving somebody and being attached to them. Loving somebody is just very straightforward. You're a sentient being. I want you to be happy. Yeah, attachment is, I want you to be happy as long as you do this and this and this. Or I want you to be happy because you do that and that and that in relationship to me. So because we have so many strings attached and all the strings are based on how they relate to me, therefore, it makes the relationship with the other person more unstable. Because as soon as my mood changes, how I perceive them is going to change. Or as soon as their behavior changes, how I perceive them is going to change. Okay? So if we're very, very attached to somebody, yeah, then we tend to have, also in addition to that, if we're attached to somebody, we have a whole lot of expectations on that person's head. We're constantly, you know, looking out, you know, in terms of are they fulfilling my expectations or not? Yeah. And that creates problems, doesn't it? I expect you to tell me you love me every day. Yeah. Well, you didn't tell me you loved me today. And I'm upset about it. And then I tell you, I'm upset because you didn't tell me you loved me today. Well, of course, are they going to tell you that they love you when you just talk to them like that? No. They're going to say, I don't tell you I love you when you talk to me like that. You know, you can't demand that I love you and tell you that I love you every day. And then we respond, well, does that mean that you don't love me? And then they respond, well, look at how you're acting. And then we respond, well, look at how you're acting. And then, you know, we have a fight. Yeah. So when we have all sorts of expectations of people, it really, you know, it's very easy to have problems in the relationship. What do you think? Of course you have different types of relationships. Like I said, you know, you have a relationship with a two-year-old that is one type, and you have a relationship with your parent that is another type, and you have a relationship with a colleague at work that is another type of relationship. So the relationships are different. Yeah. But we're trying, you know, and it takes a lot of work. We're trying to get our basic feeling for everybody to be one of open-hearted care and concern so that then we can see their kindness and see their suffering and develop genuine love and compassion for them. Okay? Yeah?
The relationships are different, but they're different as a result not of your judgment about those people, but about your appropriateness or the suitability of the relationship according to
social conventions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in your mind, you're trying to think of people equally, even though it's not appropriate to behave necessarily
equally. Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, you could extend that to them. Let me tell you a story. You know, many refugees leave, well, not so much nowadays, but in the past, a lot of refugees left Tibet. And when they escaped, when they got to Dharamsala, they would go to see His Holiness Dalai Lama. So there was one monk some years ago, you know, who got out of Tibet, went to see His Holiness. And this monk had been imprisoned for many, many years. And I think he had even been tortured to some extent. And His Holiness asked the monk, during all those years of imprisonment, what did you fear the most? Yeah. And the monk said, what I feared the most was losing my compassion for the prison guards. Isn't that remarkable? Yeah? What he feared was not what they did to him, but losing his compassion for them. Yeah? So this person, you know, was, you know, quite an accomplished person, I think. Yeah. And if you listen to His Holiness, how he talks about the Beijing government, yeah, there's been, you know, all sorts of devastation in Tibet and genocide and environmental damage and so on and so forth. And yet His Holiness says, don't hate the Chinese. Don't hate the Chinese communists. Yeah, they're sentient beings. Don't hate them. Okay, so it's possible. It's possible. And I remember one time I was watching an interview. Some reporter from the LA Times was interviewing His Holiness many years ago. And the reporter said, you know, there's been genocide and environmental destruction, and you haven't been and you've been a refugee for so many years, and you haven't been able to go back. And how come you aren't angry? And His Holiness said, well, anger doesn't do much good. If I were angry, I wouldn't be able to sleep well at night. I wouldn't be able to eat. My whole life would feel miserable. What use is anger? And this reporter from the LA Times was looking like, you know, who is this guy? Because she was giving him the perfect platform to say all these horrible things that had been done to him and done to the Tibetan people. And instead, he responded about not, you know, the value of not feeling angry. Pretty remarkable, I think. Huh? And so when I look and I see, you know, different levels of grudges that I carry over the years that I think I got rid of until I hear the person's name again and then, oh, them, you know? Okay, and then I work and I try and pacify. And okay, I'm over that now. And then I hear the name again. Yeah? And you know, my petty grievances, you know, which are nothing compared to what His Holiness has been through in his life. And yet, what's the use of me holding on to anger for these stupidagios? that happened in my life that, you know, that are here today and gone tomorrow and really don't matter in the long term, unless I imbue them with meaning that they do not have and make them into crises. Okay. So it's a challenge for us. But I think the good news is that if we really contemplate this, we'll find there's a way to let go of anger and resentment and grudges and let go of a lot of our fear of other living beings. And wouldn't it be nice to not have so much anger and fear? No, I'm not important enough to talk with George Bush, unfortunately. Yeah, but His Holiness did. And His Holiness considers George Bush a friend. Wow. Imagine that. Yeah? Did Tony Abbott talk to His Holiness? No. She turned her back. Oh. Okay. So other... Wait. Hold on. Okay. Are there any other questions? Any other questions? Nothing? Yes. Yeah. Right. Yeah. If we have expectations and we make them clear, it's very different from having all sorts of mentally fabricated expectations that we expect the other person to adhere to, even though we haven't communicated them, you know? Okay, and often we think, oh, well, you know, it goes without saying that this is my expectation. Like that other person should be a mind reader. Yeah, and then we get upset when they don't fulfill our expectation. But we never checked with them. Yeah, did you really sign up to be everything I want you to be when I want you to be it? Yeah, did you know you signed up for that when we got married? You know, they're going, oh, I didn't sign up for that. What do you want out of me anyway? Okay, so let's sit quietly for a few minutes. Think about what you heard so that you can remember it and take it home with you and practice it some more.